In the United States, a quiet girl with a guitar and a scruffy singer from Minnesota ignited two revolutions, musical and political. David Hadou wrote about Joan Baez and Bob Dylan in Positively 4th Street. He told Steve Paulson what the pair meant to the emerging folk music scene in the 1960s.
Mort Saul called them the Liz and Dick of the self-righteous set. They had very complex and relatively short-lived love affair intertwined with an equally complex and longer enduring professional relationship. And the relationship began as a professional relationship because Bob sought her out because Joan was already an enormous star and important cultural figure in post-war popular music. I mean, it's utterly forgotten today that, and I didn't put this quite this way in my book, that Joan Baez was the Elvis of the folk era. I wish I had said that, because folk music had existed for some time, of course, being folk music and all, and it had also been successful for about a decade through an older generation of artists like Pete Seeger and Lead Belly and Woody Guthrie. It was Joan who came along and translated the music and put a young, beautiful, white, although, you know, vaguely ethnic and mysterious, face on the music, like Elvis did to R&B, which had existed for a while, and attracted a whole new generation, a whole new audience.
Don't sing love songs, you'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here, right by my side. Dagger, she says that I can't be your bride.
And she was a national phenomenon. She ended up on the cover of Time magazine.
Joan was on the cover of Time magazine at a time when that really conferred authority. I mean, unlike today, Time had very few entertainers of any kind. I mean, Frank Sinatra wasn't on the cover of Time magazine, but Joan Baez was, because she was emblematic in a paradigmatic shift in post-war music and in popular culture. And she represented a radical rejection of the status quo in popular music. I mean, it's every bit as radical as rap. And she had something like 4 of the top 10 best-selling albums of the Billboard charts, was singing to sold-out audiences all around the country, and Bob Dylan was unknown. And he sought her out to give voice to his music when he began composing. She was a little resistant to Bob at first, because when they first met, he wasn't composing on the level that he would be shortly afterward. It was a little while after the first meeting when she heard him sing With God on Our Side that she realized that there was really some substance to him, and he was on to something, and on to something that could advance her music, her professionally. She had been doing traditional repertoire for some time now, ever since she began as a teenager, the same songs, essentially the same way, and critics were beginning to pick up on that. She was beginning to get her first critical reviews. So here together, they saw a way to grow as artists and soon became attracted to each other. I mean, it's also forgotten that that Joan nurtured Dylan as a composer, and he wasn't writing that much when they first met. She took him into her home, set him up, groomed him, fed him, clothed him, and nurtured his blossoming.
My name, it ain't nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was born and brought up there on the last to abide. The land that I live in is gone on its side.
Well, and to put this in perspective, when they came together, musically, they were quite different. I mean, they were both on the vanguard of the folk scene, but Joan Baez had this image of being this kind of virginal queen with this absolutely pure, gorgeous voice. And here was Bob Dylan, this scruffy little creature who obviously had a genius for writing songs, but had this strange voice. And it was a very odd combination.
Well, they had something in common, but there were also vast differences between the two of them as artists. And the differences are generational in nature. They show how Joan was essentially the last of the previous generation's kind of folk singer, and Bob was the first of the next generation. Joan was an interpretive artist, and in that way, she's connected to the whole Tin Pan Alley tradition of singers who were singing songwriters' work, but she was singing folk songs. Now, there's something revolutionary in that because of how radical folk music was as a departure from Tin Pan Alley and from the prevailing culture at the time. It's hard for us to remember how radical folk music seemed then, you know? But at the time of the boom in man-made materials, this music that's kind of natural and raw comes along. And in the 50s, Age of Conformity, here comes this music that's really strange, sung by people playing odd instruments with strange names and odd-sounding voices. So this was a very radical shift. And yet, Joan had this connection to the tradition in that she was an interpretive artist. Bob was an expressive artist. He was a creative artist. He was composing his own music. Now, not that some other folk singers of the previous generation did not compose. Woody Guthrie composed, and Bob Dylan was first inspired to compose from Woody Guthrie. But Bob went further than Guthrie, and he composed in a very personal style with much less regard for communication that made him more of a modern artist.
And there were people at the time who complained that his songs were overly wordy, that he was just putting too much stuff into them. But, of course, that proved to be his great genius, that he wasn't afraid to be a poet in song.
You know, Joan's audiences didn't like him one bit. Another aspect of their relationship that's been forgotten with time is that she gave him his start professionally. She was singing to audiences of 4,000 or 5,000 people and sold out theaters where the theater owners were setting up folding chairs in the aisles and on stage as fast as the fire marshals could come in and take them down. And Bob was singing to a few dozen people and some empty chairs and, you know, little theaters and clubs. She brought him along on a concert tour. I don't know of any other case where someone did this. You know, took another artist and turned over the stage to an unknown person for the whole second half of her shows. And her audience was not especially receptive to Bob. They would hiss, they would boo, they would talk amongst themselves, and she would have to come out and lecture them. Now listen to him, he has something to say. And as you're saying, it wasn't just his voice that turned off audiences initially. It was a very radical style of composing, you know? This very long, rambling, endless lyrics. One of the Clancy brothers said to me when he first heard one of Bob's 32-verse compositions, he said, "Bob, you have a gift, but do you have to go on so?" Or something to that effect.
I was riding on the Mayflower and I thought I spot some land. I yelled for Captain E-Rib, I have you understand. Who came running to the deck, said, "Boys, forget the whale. We're going over yonder, cut the engines, change the sails. Haul on the bowline," we sang that melody, "like all tough sailors do when they're far away at sea." "I think I'll call it America," I said, "as we hit land." I took a deep breath, I fell down, I could not stand. Captain Arab, he started writing up some deeds. He said, "Let's set up a fort and start buying a place with beads." Just then this cop comes down the street, crazy as a loon. He throws us all in jail for carrying harpoons.
What were the songs that first made him stand out when
people could see that he was this emerging genius.
The first critics to recognize Dylan as a serious composer latched on to his songs of social consciousness and his political songs that Joan Baez was encouraging him to write. And that was during the time when he was widely seen as a leader in the emerging counterculture, a young revolutionary. He didn't actually write that much material in that vein and turned away from it fairly quickly and started writing music of a personal nature, even before he started writing music the rock and roll style. He did an album called Another Side of Bob Dylan that enraged the folk purists. A good year before, he started playing a Fender Stratocaster and writing songs like Subterranean Homesick Blues. So it was originally the political component in his music, and the fact that his handling of political themes and of themes of social consciousness was oblique and poetic. He gave no easy answers. Blown in the Wind, which was the first song of his, widely revered, is not a strident song. It's not a finger-pointing song. It's a song that raises questions but doesn't provide any answers.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
When you look back at this period we've been talking about, the first half of the 60s, and think back first on the impact of Joan Baez and then Bob Dylan, how do you assess their significance in the emerging counterculture?
There's no way to underestimate Joan Baez's significance, and it's unfortunate that her diminuendo in recent decades has obscured that fact or led us to forget that fact. But she represented a paradigmatic shift in the culture, and she led a whole generation. She is a figure of profound importance who inspired Bob Dylan and nurtured Bob Dylan, who came along to evolve as an artist of even greater significance than Joan. Not only because he became more popular, but because his music was far deeper than Joan's, much more poetic and more profound and more original, far more original. I mean, he's really one of the towering figures of the last century. I mean, he looms over the last century alongside Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Frank Sinatra in popular music. And if that's the pantheon, Dylan is shoulder to shoulder and above one or two of them, arguably.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, batch out, laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway looking for a new friend. The man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10.
David Hayter is the author of Positively Fourth Street. He talked to Steve Paulson.